everybody. This is Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president in 2020. And this is Green Socialist Notes, where we talk about continuing to educate and advance the program that Angela Walker and I ran on for an eco-socialist Green New Deal and some other initiatives. So here we are, and I'm going to put in the chat when I get a minute an article I wrote on the anniversary of Biden's inauguration, which was Thursday, January 20th. And I titled it Bipartisan Biden Builds Back Bupkis. And it so happened on that day, the voting rights and election protection legislation died in the Senate after Build Back Better was defeated recently. So I think the general point is we need the Green Party more than ever because the Democrats are not getting it done. And we need to fight for an inclusive democracy at a time when the Republicans are promoting voter suppression and they're taking over election administrations so they can count the vote and suppress votes they don't like and declare their candidate won even though they didn't. And we're seeing the voter suppression already happening with voter purges. This is particularly in Georgia, but it's coming in other states. Violent intimidation of election administrators that won't toe the Republican election theft line. We have reports of high proportions of people asking for absentee ballots being denied. And then at the bigger scale, we got new reporting out in the last week or so about, I think it's seven states now, Republicans sent fake elector slates. They lost the state, but they sent them anyway, as apparently part of this whole scheme to steal the election. We just learned last night that among the Trump papers, he lost in the Supreme Court. His papers are now before the January 6th committee, the committee investigating January 6th riot in the Capitol. They had a draft executive order to have the military seize all the voting machines in the country after the 2020 election. We've got a lot of states starting with Junior Trump, Ron DeSantis down in Florida, but they're adding it. I think Texas and Arizona are now going for it. What they're calling voter fraud police. That's what the KKK was, you know, intimidating voters that they didn't want to show up to vote. They already got enforcement for voter fraud within secretaries of state and election boards. So all that's going on. And the Democrats can't get basic legislation to protect elections and give people access to the vote. And on the other hand, they're suppressing the Green Party, you know, with more onerous ballot access laws. We just had one passed in Nevada. New York had one passed in 2020. We lost our ballot line because of it. That's what authoritarian governments do. They suppress their opposition. So we're getting it from both sides of the aisle between the two major parties. So what we need to be about is an inclusive democracy that's not only about candidate access to the ballot, as important as that is, voter access to the ballot, as important as that is, but also candidate access to the ballot. Because voters should have the right to vote for who they want. And they don't have that now with the suppression of party, like the Green Party, which is a form of voter suppression. We know from the 2016 exit polls that 61% of Green voters for Jill Stein would not have gone out and voted if she wasn't on the ballot. The Green Party brings new voters to the ballot. You knock the Green Party out, you knock voters out. You suppress that vote. So we need to be about not just access to the vote and election protection so that the real vote is counted and certified, but we need to be about fair ballot access. We need to be getting somebody in Congress to introduce a fair ballot access law like the Fair Elections Act that John Conyers introduced in 1989. There hasn't been one since then. Ron Paul had a bad one. It wasn't very good. Conyers was pretty good. That's what we need. And none of these so-called Democratic Socialists and Progressives are talking about fair ballot access, a federal standard for federal elections, so we can have a multi-party democracy. They're going along with the suppression of the Green Party. We need ranked choice voting. I think I've mentioned on these podcasts an article that just came out in Harvard Law and Policy Review. Rob Ritchie at FairVote and some lawyers wrote that article, and they have model legislation in there. We could have a ranked choice national popular vote for president that just went around the Electoral College by legislation. You don't need a constitutional amendment. So, you know, if you get an opportunity, you know, Google Harvard Law and Policy Review. It's in the archives, the most recent issue, winter 2020. And you can read that bill. And you can read the whole argument that Congress has the constitutional authority to regulate presidential elections, including setting up a ranked choice national popular vote for president. So that's another thing we should be fighting for. We should be fighting for the Fair Representation Act, which has seven sponsors in the House, introduced by Don Byer in Virginia, and mostly some progressives also sponsoring, but not many of them. None of the squad members are on that bill. That's another bill we should be promoting and pushing. That would create proportional ranked choice voting for multi-member districts for the House, and for the Senate races, ranked choice voting. So that would be a big improvement, and it would create, we'd get Greens elected into the House of Representatives under that system. Because we're, you know, you have multi-member districts, you know, we're a 20 to 30% party when the playing field is level and you don't have the spoiler effect where people vote for the lesser evil rather than their most preferred candidate because they don't want to help their most feared candidate. So these are things that we need to bring up, inclusive democracy, and then getting to the Build Back Better agenda. Now, Senator Markey of Massachusetts said, actually it was the night that the voting rights was defeated, I believe, or maybe it was the next day. What, get my days mixed up. But anyway, he said he thought they could get the Build Back Better climate section passed, maybe with a couple other things that Manchin would accept that. But we have to understand that what is left in Build Back Better, and even what was originally proposed, is grossly insufficient for dealing with the climate crisis. It's all about subsidies for building renewables and buying electric cars and putting electric vehicles charging stations out there. It's all carrots to build more renewables, but there is no mandates like a renewable energy standard that we have in many of our states to reduce carbon emissions in utilities, or that's the power sector, but no other sector, not manufacturing, agriculture, transportation, or what I leave out. There's transportation, but there are five sectors. Anyway, the other sectors beside power production. And what they are willing to subsidize as quote unquote clean energy is dirty energy, nuclear power, carbon capture and sequestration of the CO2 emitted by fossil fuel burning, biogas, waste incinerators. So, you know, the kind of thing that we're talking about, serious climate action, and then the what we call an economic bill of rights, a right to a guaranteed living wage job, an income above poverty, affordable housing, quality health care, lifelong public education, a secure retirement. I think we should add in there universal child care through the public school system. I mean, that's another thing in Build Back Better. A lot of this stuff they were contracting out to private entities at more expense means testing and just making the whole system complicated and creating divisions between people that are just under the subsidies and just over. So there's a lot that we need to be advancing. We need to be out there in the streets and in every public forum available, advancing our demands without compromise or equivocation. The people are with us on a lot of these things. We've just got to organize and mobilize them and then take that into the electoral arena. And let's be clear, the leadership of the Democratic Party is moving right. If you heard Biden's news conference on Wednesday, he had a line in there, "I'm not Bernie Sanders, I'm not a Democratic Socialist." That's a signal to the progressives, leave me the hell alone. That's what Biden is saying. So they're moving to the right. They're not moving where we want to go. So, you know, we need the Green Party more than ever. And, you know, it's time to get out there and get active. So I'll stop there and look for your questions. Amy L. Sachs. Howie, is there anyone who'd appear on here to talk in more detail about fossil fuel, plastics, etc.? Yeah, I can think of a number of good people. Might start with David Schwartzman or Peter Schwartzman, who are Greens. David is a retired, I guess he was a biology professor. Anyway, retired professor at Howard University. And his son, Peter Schwartzman, who's a Green, is the mayor of Galesburg, Illinois. And the father and son, David and Peter, have written a book, The Earth Is Not For Sale, which is a good overview of the, you know, kind of transition we need to make with respect to fossil fuels and plastics and so forth to renewables. So I think it would be good to have one or the both of them on here and have that discussion. And that's just the first two people that come to mind. There are a lot of good people. I think of Sean Sweeney, who is head of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy. We were calling for international public ownership of the energy sector so we can plan the transition and get it done. He's very knowledgeable and has an international perspective. So, yeah, I think that's a great idea. And I will follow up on that. April Cook, we're fighting to bring the Greens back on the ballot here in North Carolina. We have a Green candidate being forced to run as an independent due to undemocratic and voter suppression actions of both parties. They're requiring 15,000 signatures on a petition by the beginning of May here in North Carolina during a pandemic. Yeah, I you know, one of our goals in the presidential campaign was to get on the ballot. The new North Carolina law required us to be on the ballot in, what was it, 2/3 of the states or something like that. We came up a few states short. And then we had another opportunity to get the percentage of the vote, and we came up short. So now you're stuck with this big petition. If it makes you feel any better, we got to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days in New York this year. So we got a challenge as well. And that's what we got to challenge. We need fair ballot access laws. We need to, you know, get, if we can find any friendly legislators to put a bill like we want in. And then in the course of our political campaigns and our issue campaigns, challenge those people that call themselves progressives or small D Democrats to support that bill. And if they do, that's news. They're agreeing with us. And if they don't, that's news because we're calling them out. So this is an ongoing fight. And I know that my social media has been promoting the North Carolina petition and trying to help you guys get more volunteers. I hope that's helped. But yeah, that's something that's where we need people. You know, people not just sitting online, you know, spouting their opinions, but going out and talking to regular folks, getting their signatures on ballot petitions, handing them a flyer that summarizes what we're about in our campaign. You know, that's how we're going to broaden our base. And going back to what I said earlier, you know, the people are with us on a lot of these issues. And I still haven't put that link to that article up here. I'll try to do that as we're talking. But as I pointed out there with half a dozen issues, we have strong, strong majorities with us on the Green New Deal and Medicare for All. And what else did I have on that list? $15 minimum wage and so forth. So good luck with your petition drive. So Luker Denouncer, will Matthew Ho be a guest in the future? I sent an invitation to Matthew Ho this week, as soon as I heard he'd announced to come on the podcast, to his campaign, you know, contact address. I didn't have his personal email. Haven't heard back. I will pursue that. I've followed Matthew Ho since he quit the Foreign Service. He's a former Marine like I am. Became anti-war. He was deployed in Afghanistan and really saw that the U.S. didn't even know who they were dealing with there. So he's been a good anti-militarist spokesperson. and you look at his website, I suggest people just Google it, Matthew Ho. He's got, you know, good green positions on all the issues. He has something of a, you know, name recognition. He should be a strong candidate. And that's in North Carolina, where we were just talking about the signature petition drive. So, yeah, I'm hoping to get Matthew on soon, and hopefully that'll give a bolster to the petition drive, as well as his campaign and the other North Carolina campaigns. Political Place. Howie, do you think that if the media gave third parties a chance to debate and be exposed, that more third party candidates would be elected? I think debates would definitely help. I think, on the other hand, the biggest obstacle we face is this exclusionary single member district winner take all plurality voting system. Because every time you get into that, if you have more than two candidates and you're like the Greens, you're on the left, a lot of people are more worried about the far right, which is a real worry today. It's a bigger worry than it's ever been, because the Republicans have just gone, you know, over into fascist territory. So a lot of people vote for the center to stop the far right, given single member district winner take all. That's the biggest thing we got to change. If we can change that, that will change. We'll have a multi-party system, and the Greens will be right in the middle of it. Now, of course, if you can't get into debates and people can't hear you, that hurts big time. And, you know, in my experience in New York, you know, it took us about 8 years before we got into local debates. I mean, I think at first they just thought we were a flash in the pan. And finally we got in one debate, and we did so well that, you know, then the media locally didn't want us not included, because we made it more interesting. We brought up real issues. And same thing at the state level. I mean, I wasn't able to debate Hillary Clinton running for U.S. Senate in 2006, but by 2010, I got in the gubernatorial debate with Cuomo and the rest of them, and again in 2014. In fact, you know, I think I did well, and in 2018, Cuomo refused to debate. So, yeah, the debates are important, but I think changing the way we vote is going to be the biggest change to give the Greens the representation that their policy proposals deserve for the support they have in among the voters. And I'm not going to be able, I can't do two things at once. I'm not going to be able to look up that article, but it was in Counterpunch on Thursday, January 20th, and it was called Bipartisan Biden Builds Back Bupkis, which I can think kind of sums up where we are after a year with the Biden administration and where we need to go. So Eric Gray, what is the best way to explain to the layman why we should get rid of capitalism and what a better alternative looks like? Well, I think the way we talk to people is with specific demands that they're ready to support now. People don't go out to vote or mobilize for an ism, for a whole system change. Most people don't. But they will fight for Medicare for all. They will fight for a Green New Deal to deal with climate and social protections. And then as they get involved in the movement and they see the obstacles, they begin to realize, well, who's standing in the way? It's capitalists. And then you can talk about how the system works. And, you know, when I get to that point, I often talk about capitalism being, you know, private dictatorships. When you go to work, you have no say. You got to do as work is directed. So there's no economic democracy. And then we can talk about how that concentrated wealth translates into concentrated political power. And that's why we can't get the things we want, like a $15 minimum wage. It's enormously popular. And but, you know, the damn Congress can't even, the federal minimum wage is still $7.25. You know, you can't live on that anywhere in this country now. Satino Musto. My question, libertarians have taken the title of the third party as an alternative to the two-party system. This has worked pretty well for them, getting Joe Jorgensen 1.8 million votes in 2020. But it overshadows the Green Party. Why do you think the Libertarians fare better than Greens? And what can we do to get the one up on Libertarians and break the 5% threshold? Okay, a lot in there. Third party has been a generic term, but the fact is the Libertarians are now the third party in presidential elections. The Greens are the fourth. And I think that's because the Libertarians have a very clear ideological position that neither the Republicans or Democrats represent. On the other hand, on the left, a lot of progressives who like the Green Party platform much better than the Democratic platform still vote for the Democrats in presidential elections because they want to stop the Trump Republicans, who they see as a real danger. And so we're in a different situation with the Republicans so extreme on the right. You know, people who were former Republicans and don't like that, they can vote Libertarian as a protest vote. Whereas people that want to stop the far right part in Republicans, the Libertarians aren't seen as, well, neither Libertarians or the Greens are seen as a viable option. They vote for the Democrats. So we got that dynamic going on. And 5%, that's a difficult threshold. What that would do is enable us to qualify for our prorated portion of a general election grant from the Federal Election Commission. It's in the presidential campaign fund, which funds matching funds, which Greens have been using, although the major parties have stopped using, because it's, if you take that money, you have to limit the amount of private money you can raise. So like in 2020, it was 50 million or so, and all the major party candidates could raise a lot more money from the rich. So they just left the matching funds alone. It was only the Green Party now using that. And in this voting rights legislation, first For the People Act and Freedom to Vote Act, at first they raised fivefold the amount of money we have to raise to qualify for matching funds. And then in the Freedom to Vote Act, they just eliminated all presidential public campaign funding, which is kind of astounding. The mass media, the commercial media didn't report on it. All the good government groups, from Common Cause and League of Women Voters to Public Citizen and the Brennan Center and ACLU, none of them commented. This is a major reform in 1974, post-Watergate, so that you didn't have to have just rich folks backing you to run for president. And it was totally eliminated with no comment. Now, the most recent version they voted on this week totally eliminated any reference to the presidential campaign fund. So my best guess, I've been asked, I think they just forgot. They were in a hurry. They had to slap this thing together to get a vote. The bill was dropped at 6 o'clock on, what was it, Wednesday, and they voted at 10 a.m. on Thursday. Well, no, that was the week before. Anyway, they threw it out at 6 one day and voted on it at 10 a.m. the next morning, when very few people had, members of Congress had a chance to even look at it. So I think it'll be back. They do want to get rid of the presidential campaign funding, the Democrats do, or make it so hard that, Green Party can't get into it. And they're not that interested in it. They haven't been going for it for years. The last one to accept the general election grant was John McCain. Barack Obama was the first presidential candidate to not accept it. Every candidate from, Carter and Reagan, up till Barack Obama accepted it. But Obama was raising so much corporate money, he just went against it. McCain, not so much, so he took it in 2008. But since then, none of the major party candidates have taken that general election grant, which would have been 102 million for the post-Labor Day, last 2 months of the campaign. And that's not enough when they're spending billions. But if we got 5%, they define a minor party as 5% to 25%. So if we got 5%, we get about a fifth of that $100 million. That'd be $20 million, which the Greens could do some real damage with that. So that's why we talk about 5%. But it's very difficult, given our winner-take-all system in presidential elections and the incentives that creates for voting for the lesser evil. So the best we've ever done is Ralph Nader 2000, 2.74%. And that was a year, it was an open seat. You had Gore carrying on the legacy of corporate Clinton. You had Bush soft peddling himself as the compassionate conservative, both of them thoroughly corporate. And there's Ralph Nader, universal name recognition, very popular with the people. And he still only got 2.74%. That's the strength of that spoiler effect on people's voting behavior. So that's why we got to push for ranked choice national popular vote for president, so people can vote for who they want without worrying about helping their worst enemy. If we have that, we get well over 5%. Lee Archer, how do we help Greens and the progressive movement in the American South that is generally conservative? Well, I think we need to not write off the South by any means. First of all, you have large Black and now Latino populations that are progressive, certainly on the economic class issues, on the racial justice and social equality issues. Some of those groups are conservative on some other cultural issues, but certainly they're receptive to the kinds of economic policies and environmental policies. I mean, environmental injustice is a big issue in many communities in the South. Toxic waste dumping, Cancer Alley in Louisiana, the lack of basic environmental infrastructure, water and sewage in Black communities in the South. In fact, the first lawsuit that you could call an environmental justice lawsuit was by some Black civil rights leaders in Mississippi in the early 70s, and they were suing to get water and sewage as an environmental issue. And they really paid the price. One of them was assassinated, the husband, and then the family was bombed out of their home. And their last name was Hawkins, coincidentally. There are a lot of people in the South that will be receptive to what we're talking about. And even though the white evangelical conservatives are maybe the biggest bloc in many parts of the South, particularly the rural South, the South is changing. It's becoming more urbanized, more cosmopolitan. That's why Georgia voted for Democrats in 2020, and I think all those states. So how do we help? We get out there and do what People's Action did, deep canvassing in Georgia to help try to persuade, white working class people to vote for the Democrats instead of the Republicans in Georgia in those Senate races. And deep canvassing is where you go and talk to people and you listen more than you preach. You're not just telling them, we got the answers, listen to us. You're listening to what their concerns are. And then you maybe relate them to the ideas you have to solve those problems. And they found that very effective in moving people politically. That's of all the things you can do in politics, that deep canvassing is probably the most effective way of moving people, persuading people. So how do we help? I think we need to get our locals organized and go out and do that canvassing on a year-round basis. Talk to people. Let them know who we are and what we're about, and also the fact that we're listening. Because people, even if they don't agree with you on the fine points of policy, if they even care about that, most people vote with their guts. Do they trust you? Are you for them? Are you for the people? And just by going out and talking to people, that goes a long way towards getting that relationship. So that's what I would suggest. Go local, talk to the people, and don't think you're in an area where things can't change. I think there's certainly a strong progressive plurality, if not a majority, in most of those southern states. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on prosecutors being blocked by Democratic AG from Clean Water in Flint, Michigan? Yeah, I read about that, and I think what happened was the previous prosecutors were about to indict a bunch of the people put in place that changed the water system in Flint for under the RICO Act, racketeering. And the current attorney general dropped that prosecution. And so what are my thoughts? I think that's wrong. Flint is still suffering from a water problem. And I mean, a lot of people have left that town. It's been depopulated because of the water problem. I mean, going back, for people that don't know, the Michigan governor, a Republican, took over administration of several mostly black majority, well, all black majority cities in Michigan under the guise of a fiscal crisis, which he helped create by promising revenue sharing and then denying it. And the people that took over as, what do they call them? I forget the title, but they basically, you know, were like the unelected mayor appointed by the governor. And in Flint, they decided to switch the water source from, what was it there, Lake Michigan? Anyway, one of the Great Lakes, to the Flint River, which is terribly polluted. So once that water started coming in, people's pipes corroded, they got lead poisoning and a whole lot of other ailments. And, you know, that was all in the name of economic efficiency, but it obviously wasn't, because it's going to cost a lot more to clean that mess up. So so there was, you know, a case being made by prosecutors to bring these people up on charges of fraud, I think it was, and under the RICO statute. And the current governor of Michigan, I mean, Attorney General of Michigan, dropped that case. So it's not good. Amy L. Sachs at Jay-Z. The GOP is unafraid to woo, co-opt, and absorb extreme right-wing groups, subgroups, and use them against Dems. Dems don't do that with the U.S. left. They just denigrate it and sweep it aside every time. I wouldn't agree with that. I would say the Dems use the pro-democratic NGOs funded by, you know, very rich foundations and so forth, not just to denigrate, but to, you know, exclude. And yeah, the GOP absorbs the far right. You're right. The Democrats don't absorb the far left. That is a difference. So I guess I you know, accept what you're saying. I'm just sensitive to the fact that the Democrats really try to crush the left, at least the Green Party. And a lot of people on the broader left don't realize, you know, what we go through just trying to get on the damn ballot or, you know, get included in debates or, be included in coalitions where, you know, the Greens actually brought the demand up first. I'm thinking of Green New Deal networks that, you know, have been set up by pro-democratic NGOs, and they keep the Green Party out. And well, that was our signature issue in the 2010s. They got it from us. So anyway, yeah, the GOP absorbs the far right, and the Dems keep the far left out for sure. Brant J. Gill, what's your proposed policy for assisted suicide death with dignity? For those with terminal illness, chronic pain, severe mental illness, and other afflictions that can severely impact someone's quality of life in a negative way. I lean toward doing it, but it has to be done right. I've talked with a lot of disability activists who are afraid that they're just going to be set up and pushed into getting assisted death. Because they're a burden. So, you know, I'm looking at your list, terminal illness, chronic pain. You know, if people, you know, think it's time to go, they should be able to go. But, you know, mental illness, are they competent to make that decision for themselves? So you want other people making it? So I'm open to the idea, but it has to be, the legislation has to make it clear so nobody's pushed over to, you know, out of life when they don't really want to go. (Clears throat) Frankie Lee, I still think regular people like ourselves have not organized and picked up what Bernie left for us. There are too many flamethrowers and not enough organizers and builders. I think you're right. You know, on the left, and it's not just the left, it's politics. People tend to, they call it virtue signaling sometimes, you know, beating their breasts about how right they are, instead of going out and talking to people that may not agree with you. But if you can organize and build a broad base, that's what you got to do. And I watched Bernie Sanders, you know, as a politician from 1972 in Vermont, when I dropped leaflets for him in a couple of races, and just watched him develop. And that's one thing he does. He has town meetings all over Vermont, and he takes on all comers. You know, a lot of them are very conservative, but he's won a lot of them over because even if they don't agree with him on policy, certainly don't call themselves socialists, they say, you know, Bernie talks to us, and he's got, you know, the common people's best interests at heart. And that's the way the left needs to present itself. Instead of sometimes parts of the left, and this is more, I think, coming out of, you know, sort of the middle class academic left, you know, they get picky about words people use or history they may not know. And so instead of helping people learn what they know, they denounce them as, you know, not up to snuff. And that's not a way to build a broad movement. So you've got to approach people with the idea that, you know, let's all get better rather than say, you know, you're not good enough. So I think, you know, Bernie's very good at that. And I think in that respect, he's somebody we can all learn from. Scout Trooper 164, will Donald Trump escape prosecution for financial crimes if he becomes president again? Let's see. I'm trying to remember what the law is. You can't, a president is somewhat insulated from laws, but not completely. But anyway, I think these financial crimes will be, particularly the ones here in New York, will be in court before he has a chance to get elected president again. Now, what the implications are of that, is he go on trial while he becomes president if he wins? I'm not actually sure. And will he escape? I mean, this guy, and we know him in New York. I mean, he's been a crook since he took his daddy's money and got into Manhattan real estate. And we know that. He's still able to con a lot of people. And, you know, what we're getting out of the New York prosecution is, you know, what we always suspected. He would overvalue his properties when he wanted to borrow money, and he'd undervalue them when he was paying taxes or going for, you know, to insure them. No, he'd keep them high, but when he was paying his taxes. So, you know, he's up for likely, you know, tax fraud, banking fraud, insurance fraud, and they got a lot of the paper. So it should be a case they could win. On the other hand, he's lawyered up to the hilt, and these corporate lawyers are very slick. And then the judges, you can't trust them. They are, you know, political hacks. With New York, they're probably against Trump because most of them are Democrats. But so I'm kind of speculating out loud. Will he escape? I hope not. I guess that's my bottom line answer. Carlos the Chicken. What do you think of Colbert suggesting to Elizabeth Warren on his show to abolish the U.S. Senate, something you have talked about for a while now? Yes, I think it's a great idea. It should be raised. It's very difficult to do because the fifth article of the Constitution about amendments says you have to have an unanimous consent of all the states to do it. So those little states that get overrepresented don't have much motivation to do it. The other way to do it would be to have a new constitutional convention. And given our electoral system, that would not be, it'd be highly risky. So I think we should keep raising it. Yes, I've raised it for a long time. I had an article of the Green Party USA. We had two Green Parties back then in 2000, had it as one of its planks, abolish the US Senate, which The Socialist Party, you know, I believe some of the Socialist Party had it in their platform, I think, in 1912. And we need to do that because it's obviously anti-majoritarian, because little states get two votes along with big states. So a small minority in the U.S. Senate can block stuff, or a minority representing an even smaller minority of the population can block stuff. So it should go. And, you know, back then in 2000, Ralph Nader didn't want to run and abolish the U.S. Senate, and he was concerned about that plank. So I was asked by Roll Call, the Washington newspaper that, you know, covers Congress, to write an article about that. So my first line was, Ralph Nader doesn't support it, but some Greens do. And I made the case for abolition of the U.S. Senate. I think it's something we need to keep talking about because it raises the anti-majoritarian nature of the federal government, not just with the Senate, but we have the same problem with the Electoral College, because the states get two extra electoral votes, all of them, whether they're big or small. And that's a bias toward where it is now, the rural conservative states. Robert Tarr, the ruling class will never allow us to democratically change the system in any fundamental ways. Electoralism doesn't work. It can't work. People should create or get with local inclusionary socialist organizations on the side. Then while canvassing, they can also do some base building at the same time with people who are receptive to leftist solutions. No member of the ruling class is ever going to be prosecuted by our justice system or the federal government. Electoralism on its own will never move us closer to meaningful change. Well, there I agree with you. You know, if we just run candidates and don't build a movement, the candidates will be on their own and they'll tend to be co-opted and compromised in order to get reelected. But if we just have movements without candidates, the existing power structure, the two-party system, the liberal side of it, the Democrats, will take the movement for granted. So I think also we can, particularly at the municipal level, we can build counterpower. You know, local government in our country has a lot of powers, from, you know, taxing and procurement and legislation to eminent domain. We can begin to socialize local utilities and key industries. You know, I live in a city with no grocery stores. We're a food desert. You know, the Socialist Party back in Milwaukee, when people were hungry in the 2010s, set up municipal grocery stores. You know, we can do things like that. And as we do those things, people get a practical experience with socialist institutions, and it becomes easier to then talk about them going to scale at the state and federal level. So we can't have a national movement for fundamental change that can take on this ruling class without it being well-grounded in local communities that have mass support. So I think I agree with you. I can't see the first part of your question, but I think I hit all the points. Deborah Sousa Oliveira, how can we prevent folks who work for boards of election of telling voters to want to choose the Green Party that they are not a legitimate party? Well, when we find cases of that, we got to publicize it, go to the newspapers, because it's scandalous. Boards of elections are supposed to be nonpartisan. And if they are steering people away from the Green Party, and we've had that in New York, we've had, you know, officials at boards of elections say you can't register in the Green Party. Yes, you can, even though we don't have a ballot line. We won a lawsuit 20 years ago on that one. So you got to call them out. You got to stay on top of it and call them out. And again, often the boards of election officials, sometimes it's not for nefarious reasons. It's because they're ignorant. I mean, don't overestimate how smart people in government are. I mean, we got a county board of election commissioner in a very liberal city where people want to do ranked choice voting, and she's telling you can't do that. Yes, you can. We got case law. One of the Greens here in New York wrote a nice memo citing the home rule law of the state and the case law where these kind of questions have been developed. And we had to educate that commissioner of elections in that county. And, you know, she was genuinely surprised and thanked us for bringing her up to speed. So, yeah, sometimes it's nefarious and sometimes it's just ignorance. Eric Gray, thoughts on how to curb the influence, political power of churches as a whole? Well, you know, which churches? I mean, the Black churches in the Civil Rights Movement had a good impact, and they were the place where, you know, the Martin Luther Kings of the movement organized a lot of people. On the other hand, we got these right-wing evangelical churches that are doing things going the other way. So, I think we got to relate to the faith communities on their own terms and, you know, bring them into our politics where, you know, we agree on values and policy. Now, churches get special benefits from the government and in some cases, you know, tax breaks and so forth. And if they abuse those, which some of them definitely are, you know, that needs to be curbed for sure. Because the purpose of those tax exemptions are so people can go about their faith practices and their good works, not engage in politics. And we know that today it's a lot of these evangelical churches, the preachers preaching politics from the pulpit. And, you know, that's not why they got tax exemptions. So I think that's an area where we need to, you know, have our law enforcement people and the IRS, you know, keep on top of what's going on in these religious organizations. Blind Boy Wilson, efforts must be made to attract and recruit the young for the Green Party agenda. No argument from me on that. And, you know, the question is how you do that. And I think what we need to do, I mean, one thing I think the young are not, you know, what they don't like about the Biden administration is it's been compromising on things like, or not doing it at all, on things like student debt relief and climate action. So I think one thing the Greens can do is by speaking out clearly, but also giving room for the young. You know, when young people come in, make sure they're welcomed and introduced and oriented. Don't just assume they're gonna know how to get involved in our organization without some help and some, you know, welcoming and orientation. Russell Fedorka, Howie, give your best sales job to encourage people to run for local or national office with the Green Party. Well, from my personal experience, the best platform I've ever had to speak to the most people or platforms has been running for office. And, you know, Greens tend to come with ideas and the Democrats and Republicans don't, particularly in local races. You know, they tend to run on, you know, I grew up here. I went to the high school with y'all. I'm in the Rotary Club or whatever with y'all. So vote for me because I'm, you know me. And the Greens in there saying, you know, we need A, B, and C to solve the problems in this community. And then those candidates got to respond. So, you know, if you've been frustrated by, you know, writing letters to that or going to public hearings or going to demonstrations, you know, consider running for office as a place where a lot more people will hear what you're talking about. And you have a natural excuse to knock on doors and talk to strangers you normally wouldn't have. So I think running for office is one of the best platforms we have to advance our politics. So if that's what you want to do, consider running for office. And also, don't think you got to, you know, have a PhD in politics or something to run. Because, you know, look at the people that are running your cities and school boards. You know, they're not geniuses. They're not rocket scientists. They are regular folks. And a lot of them really don't know much about what they're talking about. So don't think you're not qualified. You know, this is a democracy. The people, you know, rule themselves, and you should be able to run for office and do a good job. So I do encourage people, and I hope that convinced somebody listening to run. Frankie Lee. Howie, what can we do to encourage groups to work to repurpose old buildings for homeless shelters? Well, you can do it through mutual aid groups and nonprofits, but really should be a policy of our, you know, cities and towns. We have old buildings or just abandoned buildings that aren't that old, and we got homeless people. So there's a natural program. You know, you put people to work, rehabbing those buildings, and then putting people in the shelters. Then the only question is, you know, how do you fund that? And that's where we got to get into progressive taxation. And where you have housing authorities, public housing authorities, why can't they do that? Well, there's the Faircloth Amendment, which was passed in the Clinton administration, that said you can't increase the number of public housing units in this country. Which, and well, this is a New York thing. Andrew Cuomo was Secretary of HUD at the time, which basically pushed all the federal and state support toward affordable housing into subsidizing private developers to build it. So that's something we got to change so that we can build more public housing, because that's the only way we're going to make sure everybody has access to affordable housing. Some of the countries in Europe have like 30% of their housing stock is public housing, and people from all income backgrounds use it. It's not just like it is here, about 1% of all the housing, and only mostly poor people of color are in there. So they're segregated by race and class. Often these projects are built in undesirable parts, isolated parts of cities, and it just makes things worse. In Europe, you know, professional people, blue-collar workers, as well as low-income people, all live in public housing. So they desegregate to a much greater degree than we have. In fact, we're going the opposite direction. We're becoming more segregated by race and class, really since about 1980. We just had a brief period where it was against the law after the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And then after a few court decisions and a change in national leadership, there's been no serious effort to desegregate housing, which leads to desegregated schools and a segregated society, which denies opportunities to poor people of color in particular, but also makes a lot of white people ignorant because they just live amongst themselves and they fear other kinds of folks that they don't really need to fear. And so that's a danger too of segregation. So I think we got to fight for that policy at the municipal level. You know, house the homeless in the abandoned buildings and find the money to do it. Nick Obregon, you're president today. Congratulations. What do you say publicly about Sinema and Manchin for blocking the voting rights bill by declining to reform the filibuster? And what kind of a unique perspective do you have on this issue, having faced hurdles to ballot access? Well, you know, what I critique Biden and particularly the progressive Democrats, they played an inside game. They spent the whole year negotiating with themselves, and they're really negotiating with Sinema and Manchin, who are allied with the Republicans on cutting back Build Back Better, on not going through the voting rights bill without lifting the filibuster. So they were in a weak position, and they weren't negotiating from a position of strength. So how do you build the strength? You mobilize people, you go out to the public. The public wants voting rights. Therefore, most of the things in the Build Back Better bill, when asked about them specifically, by overwhelming majorities, and they're not being heard. In fact, you look at the polling, most Democrats don't realize how the Republicans are, you know, creating an authoritarian system in elections. It's the Republicans that think we have a crisis in democracy because they bought the big lie that the election was stolen from Trump to Biden. So That's what I say. We need to go out. If I was president, they call it the bully pulpit, man. I'd have been preaching about what needs to be done and urging people to get mobilized and going around the country instead of, you know, meeting with Manchin and Sinema in the White House, where they really disrespected him. I mean, Sinema, as Biden went over to speak to the Democratic Conference of the Senate, gave a speech on the Senate floor saying, I'm not going to support filibuster change. That was last week. And then, 2 weeks ago. And then this week, Manchin basically did the same thing while Biden was giving his press conference. Manchin went out and did his own statement that he wasn't going to, you know, change the filibuster. You know, you're not even getting respected. You're not using your strength. That's what Biden's problem is. That's why I call him bipartisan Biden. Built back bupkis. I mean, that's what happened. So if I was president, I'd play the outside game because I realized that the balance of forces in Congress are not in my favor. So we got to lay the basis for that. Either a movement that forces the Manchins and Sinemas to react and come over to our side, or at least lays the basis for what we get in the next election. And now they're starting to do that as they go into the 2022, but it's, I think, kind of late for that for them. Steve Talbot, if you could give one book that you recommend to read about politics, economy, etc., what would it be? Oh, man. I would guess there's a book by Mike Davis that was written in the mid-80s called, what was it called? Oh, man. I can't remember the title. Yeah, it was about basically the history of left politics and working class movements and an explanation as to why we don't have a independent party of the working class. And it gives a very good historical perspective. And I got to get you the title because Mike Davis is a pretty common name. Prisoners of the American Dream, I think that's it. Yeah, Prisoners of the American Dream. So that, I think, you know, kind of puts politics and the economy in American history and perspective. So if I had to pick one, off the top of my head, that would be it. And it's 4:00. Where did the time go? Well, we're going to have some guests coming up. I hope one of them is Matthew Ho, the now Green Party candidate for senator from North Carolina. Get some climate experts on that Amiel Sachs suggested. And, you know, keep having these discussions. And I don't really have anything to add that maybe I can get that now that we're a little bit slowed down and we're ended up, unless it got posted. The article I wrote for it was in Counterpunch this week, and I'm really not good at what they call it, multitasking. But here, I can get it here in a second. I'll put that link, or we'll put that link in the chat. You're not supposed to have dead air time on this stuff, but here it is. So anyway, that kind of summarizes where, you know, my thoughts are this right now. We got to I'm putting it in the Okay, it should come on the comments soon. You know, basically we got to go out there, like I was saying in response to what I would do as a president, go out and talk to the people, get them organized and mobilized around issues that we have, you know, policies that we have that they already support by overwhelming majorities. And in fact, if I can do this in that article, I cited some of the polling. And I'll just tell you what it is. Yeah, Green New Deal. This is recent polling, 63%. Medicare for All, 72%. I took the Fox News exit poll from 2020, where they called it government-run health insurance. And Fox News was trying to get a low number, and they got 72% before that. Medicare drug price negotiations, 83%. And that was supposed to be in Build Back Better, but Sinema killed that. Tuition-free public college, 63%. Student loan forgiveness, 66%. $15 minimum wage, 64%. Paid family leave. We're like the only country besides a few Pacific Islands that don't have it. Even Afghanistan got it. Paid family leave, 75%. Tax the rich, 71%. These are issues that we can build, you know, candidacies and issues and movements around. And we got to do it because obviously the Democrats haven't done it. We've watched them this year. And they, you know, negotiated against themselves and came up with bupkis. So, you know, it's up to us to go out there and you know, work on these things. And, you know, these are life or death issues. We got a climate catastrophe pending. Inequality kills. Life expectancies in this country have been declining since 2015, before the pandemic. And the pandemic just exposed how this lack of a public health care system, it exposed the inequalities in access and to treatment. And then we got this new nuclear arms race accelerating, US, Russia, China. And I don't think they're gonna go to war in the Ukraine. You know, I could be wrong, but I think, you know, it'd be stupid. But on the other hand, wars get started for stupid reasons, accidents. And, you know, Russia and the United States got enough nukes to kill us all. So these are things that we just can't sit back and watch. We gotta be active on. So I hope y'all find a way to be active on a consistent basis, and have a good week. Watch out for the Omicron. It seems like it's peaked, but a lot of people have been hit. Our hospitals here are not doing elective surgery. They're so packed. We had 10 die. You know, this is just one county of 500,000. 10 died yesterday, according to the newspaper. So, you know, take care of yourself. Have a good week, and we'll see you next week.